Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 23rd, 2017, and welcome to episode 151 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computing news, nostalgia, and collecting, and guys trying to use the internet. My name is Jack, and with me I have an esteemed group of fellows around the world. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Summer is just about here, and I'm cleaning up my office, so I'm sort of boxing everything up into nice little translucent boxes, and things are busy, but things are well.
Good. Little spring cleaning. Nice. Yep. Earl, how about you? How are things in your neck of the woods?
Hey, they're good. Things are good here. Had a sunny day yesterday. It's a little cloudy today, though, but that's, you know, kind of par for the course in Portland.
Weird.
Yeah, just weather. How does it work?
A sunny day and then a cloudy day. Man. All right, Michael, how about you? How are things down under?
Oh, well, I managed to get my network connection going, but yeah, it's been a very exciting time. So I think the most interesting thing that happened is just the evening after our last RCR podcast, I had a tree fall down in a storm and knock out my power and phone line.
Oh, wow.
Each time we record, there's some disaster here. Last time it was a flood.
Well, I'm kind of hoping that's it, because I've had three of the four elementals. I've had the scorching heat of summer. So that's fire. I've had water with the flood through the garage and the workshop, and now I've had air as wind blowing down a large tree. So that kind of leaves the earth elementals, and I'm not really interested in an earthquake right now.
How about a mudslide?
Yeah.
That would be very hard, seeing I'm on a sandstone ridge.
So, volcano.
We'll come up with something.
I'm sure we can. Yeah. I'll let you know what happens tonight.
We'll get you covered.
I continue to be impressed with how rugged you are, Michael, and in the land in which you live. It is, you're truly a warrior.
I think it's just an accident.
It does seem like a harsh environment, but then you post adorable pictures of animals in your backyard. Seem like out of fairy tales.
Yeah, they make it all worthwhile. The cute furry animals that come up to visit.
Nice. Aww. All right. Well, I'm here in Sweden, and as always, the weather is terrible. It's snowed a bit today.
Seriously? You know. That's amazing.
Nothing that would stick to the ground, but just we were driving. It's like, oh, it's snowing now. Oh, now it's raining. Oh, now it's snowing again. That sort of thing. But anyway, enough of that. Enough of weather. Let's move on to stuff. I have a topic for today. The topic is, I started thinking about, you know, we and all of our listeners are very much interested in kind of this old stuff, clearly. And I was having a conversation at work. We were talking about video games. Someone was talking about the classic Nintendo NES and playing Super Mario Brothers. And one of the guys at work, he's a younger guy, younger than me. I mean, I don't know, but he's 25 or 30, I guess. And he said something like, well, people were talking about being able to set up a Raspberry Pi to emulate games on and plug into the TV, that kind of thing. And he said, well, you know, I have an Xbox One or a PS4 or whatever he has. Like, why would I want to play any old games? I've got the great new games. and like conversation went on. I didn't really kind of like challenge him and try and prove to him that he was wrong because he should play Jumpman. But I, which is what I should have done.
You guys didn't have any contests of strength or anything like that.
We'd have a Space Invaders challenge. No, but so I was thinking about it, and my kind of gut reaction was to think, well, that's kind of a statement to make that lacks a lot of history. People would not typically say that about novels or movies or music in the same way. Like, oh, I don't need to read any old literature. I've got the new literature, right? People who are interested in reading literature, reading novels, they're probably going to want to read old novels too. Likewise, music, movies, all sorts of culture. It's generally accepted by people who are interested in the current products of that culture that they want to experience the old ones too, eventually at some point. But I feel like there is very much a lot of people in our modern world who have the latest video games, and that's what's marketed and that's what's pushed and that's what people are into. And likewise, computers. People, by and large, when I try and talk to people about 8-bit computers at all, most people have no idea what I'm talking about, and then wonder if, even if they get it, they wonder why I'm talking about it at all. Like, it's just not even like, and I don't know. It's like you would have, I don't know what it's like. like for instance, in my general daily life, if I mention to someone an Apple II, they think I'm talking about a Mac II. People don't have a memory that far back. Typically people who were not into it at the time. And I kind of think that, in a sense that, well, this stuff it's important in a way, is kind of my feeling about it. But at the same time, I realize that computer systems that were in use before I was using computers in the earlier 70s and the 60s and the 50s are all things that I have no direct experience of and have only kind of read about. So I guess my topic that I'm thinking about here is, well, it's just sort of this, like, to what degree are the things that we're doing or that we're focused on and thinking about, are these things important and useful for people who don't necessarily have an interest in it, have not gravitated to it? Is there some usefulness from learning about these things apart from just the nostalgia view? And I'd like to just hear what everyone thinks about this. We can take, I guess, the same order. Paul, what do you say about this?
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, it seems like, to the extent that history is important, then I suppose it is, right? I mean, like, I don't know if we're really in that quite doomed to repeat ourselves cycle in computers as much. But yeah, no, it's true. Like, if someone never did learn about the Atari 8-bit, how would that change their life?
Right.
It's quite possible I'm sure that it's important. You know, if you're trying to reconstruct what the culture was like in the 80s or whatever, it might be useful. But it's true, actually, when you were talking about that it was super important probably to all of our lives. You know, this was very central to our experience of the 80s. But there were many, many other people who didn't encounter these at all. You know, there was a set [S2] Right. [S1] Of people around who saw them in school and, you know, mocked the people who spent their time on them and then forgot about them. And so for them, probably it's not important at all, but it does seem to me like, I guess the concern is that there is information kind of degrading and getting lost, that if it's not saved somehow, then we'll never, even if it turns out for some reason to be important later, it won't be accessible anymore. So I guess it's important. It's important to keep the option open.
Interesting. Earl, what do you think?
Paul has a interesting point there, that we don't want the history to be lost. Is it important to everybody, though? I would say no. I would say it's important that it be important to some people. Because, a case could be made that the programmable digital computer is the most important or impactful invention in the history of mankind, because it has so permeated our lives at this point that it is difficult to think what life would be like without computers and communication devices that we all just take for granted. And with something that important, it seems kind of commensurately important that we preserve the history of it as much as we can in as high fidelity as we can. And people are doing that. People who are interested in doing it are actively undertaking it. And those things are getting archived. The culture is being preserved in books and videos and recreations and that kind of thing. But is it important just generally to the general populace? I don't know. Maybe not. But as long as if one day somebody goes, computers, that's kind of interesting. Those things really started to take off in the 1970s and 1980s, right? What was it like back then? If they can go find that information, then I think it's good that it was important to some people who took the time to be interested in it.
Right. The things are important enough to somebody to actually archive it and make some sort of record of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
For the future, for the people who do find some reason to go back and look for it.
There's another interesting piece of this that I've often mentioned to people who wonder about this hobby of mine, you know, this weirdness of collecting and using these old computers. If you want to learn the science of computing, especially from first principles, I think it's a lot easier to do that on old computers. I've mentioned this on this podcast too. I think it's way easier to do it on the old simple machines where you could really understand how they tick as opposed to a modern multi-core, extremely deep and wide kind of computing environment like we have today, where people spend their entire lives specializing on just one piece of it. And even with that speciality, don't necessarily master every aspect of it. So,
right. Yeah, I think that ties in pretty well with what I've seen as well. And in fact, I remember shortly after this, some of the same people were involved in another conversation at work where someone was asking somebody, and this is all programmers, we were talking about programming stuff, and somebody asked somebody else, oh, have you ever, you know, tried building something in assembly? And the guy said, well, nah, not really. We did a little bit of that in college, but I never really did anything after that. And I think part of the problem is that, sure, you can code an assembly on a modern PC or Mac, but the assembly languages available for modern CPUs are sufficiently complex, and the systems are sufficiently complex that I would kind of argue that these languages are not necessarily even made, they're not really designed for humans to use that much. They're designed as a compiler target, in a sense. Mm. Whereas the older CPUs that we're more, you know, from our youths, are meant definitely to program in the assembly language, which gives you some value. You know, you can fire up JavaScript 6502 assembler emulator in a browser and play with it and do something interesting in a way that is harder to do out of the box with any computer you might buy. So, Michael, what do you think about this?
Well, pretty much I run along the same lines as Earl was just talking about, so that it's important enough that it be important to some people. And just going back to your original musing upon that conversation, I find exactly the same issue. Also, it spreads not just in retro computing, but into everything. I know quite a lot of people who won't watch movies because they're black and white, or aghast. People who are, say they're Doctor Who fans, but they won't watch the classic episodes because of the lack of special effects, or precisely the type of special effects that are in them. Right. To me, retro computing is hands-on history. Like the rest of you, grew up as this was dawning. Might have been a bit later for me. Personal computers were something that existed when I went to university, and they hadn't existed really prior to then, apart from in movies, albeit they were black and white movies, also with lousy special effects. But to me, I basically try to make people aware of it, more for nostalgia for me, and also just to highlight the changes and where it all built upon. It's a bit like car enthusiasts. There are a lot of car enthusiasts that like cars from a certain era, and they were not even born. Now, I know one guy, his parents weren't even born in the era of cars that he's interested in. He's interested in the cars of the 40s. And it's just something that he said, it just caught his attention. He had no real interest in it. And then he got an interest in cars, and then he just wanted to restore those kind of early vehicles. You know, we don't know who nostalgia is going to grab by the throat and drag them into that strange and musty environment. But it's important that those people who are interested in the older computers make sure that information is available, because someone else in the future, unfortunately, is going to have to carry the torch for us. Now, we're not going to be here forever unless we can find a way of dumping ourselves down into our 8-bit machines. That'd make an interesting movie. But we have to do what we can just to sort of keep that information, that feeling available. The 70s and the 80s, I think, were the era of knowing your computer inside and out. I attempted to keep that knowledge level up as time progressed, but I think I gave up on that back in the mid 90s. It just got all too much, all too wide, and you just couldn't get the required depth. And so I just fell back to my 8-bit machines that I was most comfortable with.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But I do think that you mentioned the feeling, and I think you can still get a kind of a, I don't know, surge from, like, I could imagine today's kids being still as, you know, more or less as excited as we were to make a program that runs and goes on a simple machine that they can understand. I mean, like, just handing out Raspberry Pis isn't quite the same. And you could make a modern computer that is that simple. No one does, really, but you could. But, it does sort of seem like that aspect of the early simpler computers, there is still kind of like an emotional attachment you can get there as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I think, and this is something we've talked about before, the kind of immediacy of the old machines, that when you turn them on, you are typically given a prompt that is, you know, often a basic prompt or something. It's basically saying, here I am, time to write a program. Like, there's not really a... You don't start off with a launcher like you do now. Right. It's like if you have nothing plugged in, you turn it on, you get a ready prompt, and you can start typing in a program, which is, like you said, there is no computer that works that way today, that is sold that way.
The command line interface.
Command line interface. Yep. That's what we had. That's all we had.
Had to get the CLI in there somewhere.
I know. Yep. Had to. That's fine. It's good. Yeah, well, good. Thanks for your opinions on this, guys. It was interesting to hear. I think we're all kind of on the same page here in a lot of ways. It's interesting to sort of kind of formulate it. Yeah, the thing I was going to say is that, like, they're interesting lessons that people can very easily skim by when they don't learn about these things. Like, one thing that I gave a little talk to some colleagues a few years ago where I described a very simple arcade game that I wrote and published for the iPhone. And then after building that, I took it and kind of backported it to the Atari 2600. And it's a very simple game, and the Atari version is not complete. It's kind of the core gameplay, right? And I compared the result of this, that this game that I wrote in Objective-C compile on the iPhone, you know, compiled to something like 38K compiled, plus it's linked into system frameworks totaling like 60 megabytes or whatever. And the Atari 2600 version of this that I coded in assembly is something like 450 bytes.
Nice.
Right? And then when you're running that, also on that machine, there is no other software running, right? You install your little assembly program that you have, and that's it. You're just talking to hardware. And I think that's the kind of lesson that can blow people's minds when they get it, because it's so different from what we have now. Everything we build now is, you're always building something that's at the uppermost layer of this ocean of system beneath you. And we were much closer to the bottom of the ocean back in those days. And the ocean was small. It was a little puddle. All right.
So what you're saying is today's modern computing is like Sara Lee, layer upon layer upon layer.
Yes. Pretty much it. I just want that frosting spread right in the bottom of the pan.
Mm.
That's all I need. All right, let's move along. We got some listener feedback. John posted on Facebook about an Apple III that he picked up at a thrift store. I think he wrote that it worked at the thrift store, and he took it home and turned it on, and the magic smoke escaped immediately.
Which he caught on video, which is pretty cool.
Right.
So you can watch the magic smoke escaping.
Beautiful thing. But it sounds like, from the comments that I read, it looks like it's probably reasonably easy to fix that, right?
Yeah, there's a filtering capacitor that sits at the edge of the power supply that regularly blows out on Apple IIIs particularly, but Apple IIs also.
Okay.
So, and it's not needed for operation. It's basically just to protect the power supply from, you know, whatever noise in the power current, so it can run without it. But they smell really bad when they go. Mm-hmm. and it's probably better to replace it. But
right.
Who's lucky enough to find an Apple III at a thrift store these days?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Wild too.
It's amazing. I don't find anything good at thrift stores. I keep trying. I never find anything. I'm probably in the wrong country for it.
I used to, but...
Yeah.
Like really grungy mice.
Yep, grungy mice, grungy Acer keyboard.
Right.
Best I can come up with. I should start collecting those. This is the best retro computing I can find at thrift shops in Sweden.
You're grungy in on the ground Acer floor, keyboard. Man.
All right. Moving along, we have a press release from Lauren about the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs in Seattle. Have a new permanent Apple exhibit covering the first two decades of Apple, including Steve Jobs' demo Apple I.
Yeah, that's
very
cool.
Yay, LCM plus L.
Yeah, the demo Apple I thing is it's basically, as I understand it, an Apple I board in kind of a case, you know, so it kind of looks like a, you know, like Apple II or something. You know, it basically has a keyboard and a box around it, and, you know, I guess it would be carted around to demonstrate it to people. But and so from what I understood, essentially when Steve Jobs, you know, got booted from Apple, he left his office in kind of a hurry, and this was like in the closet. So
cool. We got an email from Tony congratulating us on episode 150 and telling us that he went back and started listening from episode 1. And I have to say that, Tony, you're a better person than I. I sure haven't done that.
Yeah. It is a lot, actually. So, it is kind of amazing.
It is a lot. It's a lot of episodes. And we make long episodes, too. Think of the massive road trip you would require to listen to all these episodes in one road trip. You're driving for days.
Like a road trip to the moon or something. I don't think you can do that, though.
Maybe Sydney to Missouri.
Yeah.
Weird road, but yeah. We got an email from Ryan about a forthcoming book on the Apple II by David Craddock. It's called Breakout, subtitled How the Apple II Launched the Gaming Revolution. Rather bold claim. And this was inspired by the fact that we mentioned the similarly titled Breakout, subtitle How Atari 8-Bit Computers Defined a Generation. And I don't know. To me, it's clear which of these had more interesting games to play in terms of things that actually... I mean, sure, Apple II, fine. But anything you could do on an Apple II, you could do on Atari. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, although I think it was earlier, right? So.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
Yeah, so
just barely.
I don't know too much about the book or the author. I came across this like a couple months ago, actually. I mean, this is a book sort of in progress. It has a release date, so you can pre-order it, the Apple II one, I mean.
Right.
And so I don't know. I mean, obviously I will read it, but I don't really know what to expect from it. So.
No.
Well, I'm just waiting for the next book to be announced, which is Breakout, How Commodore Defined the Next Generation, but it didn't because it's still loading.
Yeah. How Commodore will soon define.
Oh, man. Limitless Breakout. All right, and we talked about a weird computer we saw that was labeled Your Computer, and we got contacted by Blake, Ian, and Andrew, and maybe more people, telling us that this was one of several names that a computer called the Lambda 8300 was sold under. This is a ZX81.
Ah.
And we can have some interesting to that.
Yeah, so the on oldcomputers.com it lists DEF 3000, Power 3000, BASIC 2000, BASIC 3000 as names, Marathon 32K, Futura 8300, Your Computer, and others.
Nice.
Was this computer actually worthy of all these monikers?
Do not.
I wonder.
I don't know.
A computer by many names, none of which masks the fact that it's pretty limited.
Yeah. Well, I think Ian actually had one and had, you know, tested it out and sold it and stuff. So we know at least one person has had one in hand. But I didn't get any review of it beyond that, except that it was tested to work and then sold.
Loved it so much, didn't keep it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in the sales world, in early computer retail, I mean, one of the things they taught salespeople was try to establish in the conversation the ownership of the computer to the customer as opposed to yourself. Like, not what would you do with this Commodore 64 in your living room, but what would you do with your Commodore 64 in your living room? You see that little subtle difference there? So actually naming the computer your computer seems like it takes the next logical step in that. You have to buy it. I mean, it's your computer.
Very weird.
Compels you. It's using some subtle neuro-linguistic programming in there to compel you to buy a computer.
How did we not all have one?
It's built right into the name. Nice. Okay, the other piece of feedback we got from users was Blake sent us a link to a YouTube video posted by Ian Finder with some comments talking about various things symbolic. So we talked about some symbolic stuff a few episodes ago, including some talking about some functioning hardware at the People's Computer Museum in Seattle. I have not looked at this at all. Have you guys looked at this?
Well, I looked a little bit. It's and it was a while ago now that I looked at the video that that Blake linked to. But it's basically sort of like working out an animation on a Symbolics machine, and I think projecting it onto a wall. You know, it's pretty impressive looking. But apparently, Ian Finder here is one of the leading Symbolics people out there working with the hardware. But it does actually seem like a non-trivial community. It's just one that I almost have not intersected with at all. So,
right.
Still interested. Still haven't gotten any further than, you know, whenever it was, an episode or two ago when I basically brought up an emulator on my computer. But.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, let's move along to some items of interest and some news. Michael, we were bashing Commodore a bit a minute ago, but you have something interesting Commodore related.
Yes. I try to be fair to all the machines, but this one caught my attention. It's an interesting blend of an emulator and a hardware recreation. So what we have here is the Amiga project for an Amiga 500 retro gaming machine. Now, it comes in two flavors, one with and one without a built-in 3.5-inch floppy drive. And the idea is that you can plug this into your modern HDMI TV monitor and play all your favorite games on a 720p device, either widescreen or the original 4:3. Now, what's interesting, with the one that has the floppy drive built in, and the other one I believe has a floppy drive interface, you can't actually boot off the floppy drive. What it is basically an included way of putting your disk in, unprotected disk, and having it imaged to the SD card that is actually in the device, and then you run from that disk image. So I quite liked that idea that for people who had a sense of nostalgia, they wanted to play with the Amiga 500 on their living room TV, and here was a simple way of just drop the disc into the machine and it will automatically create the ADF file, and then you can start playing with it. Now, I've included a link to the actual website that sells these. The floppy, built-in floppy drive one is currently out of stock, but the standard one is still available. And there's also a very good review with the full edition of the Amiga 500, and they're also providing that as a competition prize. Now, obviously, they're doing this to gain extra viewers of their newsletter and their YouTube channel and whatnot. But if you're willing to provide an email address and a few jump through a few other hoops, you could be in the chance to win one of these. And as I said, it is an interesting device, and I'm actually quite interested in getting one of these. I don't have an Amiga at the moment, and if I could get the one that has the built-in 3.5-inch drive, funnily enough, I do actually have some floppy disks.
It's quite cool. I think that I used to have a huge stack of Amiga floppies, and I think I actually threw them away.
Oh, no. Yeah.
This is before I kind of got religion and started thinking about collecting things again. This is probably 10 or 15 years ago. I think I threw them away. Sad. Yeah. But the device seems very cool. And I mean, there's no end of things you can download.
It's 190 euro. So I thought I'd better put in the price there. So not the cheapest, right. But it's quite a nice little bundle.
And the one without the floppy was what, 119?
119, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And considering that there are so many images of games and things you can download off the internet, that's probably no problem to fill up that little SD card anyway without even using floppies.
Yep. So I'd recommend the one without the floppy, but by all means, go over to the link for the review, and if you want to get in there with a chance to win the 190 euro one.
Cool. The Amiga. It's nice.
It looks interesting. And actually, underneath it, it has Android, or at least it has Android available. So you can actually also just use it as an Android device. So I guess one thing I'm wondering is, how does this differ from running an emulator on, like, a Raspberry Pi? You know, I think they built or designed the board. Like, I think this is not... Mm. This isn't just installed on a Raspberry Pi. This is, in fact, something of their own design. But I'm not quite sure exactly what advantage this provides, particularly with the one without the 3.5-inch drive. I don't know.
I was kind of wondering about that myself.
They do show things like a graphical menu and a game browser, which I guess are essentially Android apps that are designed to run the thing for you. So probably when you boot this up, you essentially, like you said, it's probably Android that has one or two ready apps installed that are things for launching the games.
Because I've got a fairly recent version of Amiga Forever from Cloanto that is a, you know, full suite of emulator and tools and software and also official licenses. Like they mentioned here, if you buy the Amiga, you get a Kickstart 1.3 and a 3.1 license that comes with it, which is good. The Amiga is one of, I think, a very small group of computers. It might be the only one that I know of where the intellectual property for the ROMs maintained enough of a chain of custody where you can actually still buy an official one if you want to.
Right.
So that's cool. But yeah, I wonder how it would differ from, other than the fact that it's a cool form factor, you just easily pick it up and take it with you.
Hmm. Yeah. So I guess we'll, I have not watched the review, video. I should do that. I'm curious.
Yep. I am as well. Paul, speaking of emulation, you've got a different kind of emulation going on here.
Yeah. Tell us about. So, the news item here is that early Mac emulation has come to the Internet Archive. So within, recent times, there's been a push on the Internet Archive to embed generally JavaScript in-browser emulation of the various bits of software that they've had up there. So I've mostly seen this with Apple II software, but you can do this with PC software, with I think Atari software, and others, I assume. It's basically a like a at least a lot of this is based on a JavaScript translation of MESS, the MESS project in MAME. And I think the PC stuff might be based on something that originates with DOSBox. But so what's new here is that now the 68K Macs have an in-browser emulator, and so there's a software library of early Mac stuff. So if you want to, apparently what everybody did is went and played Dark Castle, so which you can do. I actually started with Shufflepuck, but apparently I was in the minority. But it works, it works well, and I'm interested to see how this goes. I think it is going to turn out to be a very good thing to have these little, zero configuration in-browser emulators that just go. You don't have to figure out how to install your thing and find the ROMs and whatever. It's just there.
Right.
So the collection is not huge yet, but they're looking for stuff, and I think this will be good when it is built out. And I'm actually, it's good that it's on archive.org. There are a couple of other places that have Mac software archived, but like this one called Macintosh Garden that has a lot of stuff. But I always feel like I'm never quite sure if the software is still going to be there next time I look. So
yeah,
and yet I still have not had the energy to just download everything. So
right. Yeah, it is nice to have it on the Internet Archive and have that stability that you know is going to be there. And especially because it can be a bit daunting to just sort of try and download everything. I actually recently did go, and there's a huge Atari 8-bit collection on the Internet Archive. And I actually installed the CLI app called IA that lets you just interface with I didn't even know this was a thing. You can just sort of grab files off there. And so I was able to quickly grab all of the disk images and card images that I could find. It took a long time to run, considering it was only like 70 megs of stuff. It took hours just because it's, it's fairly, I don't know.
Well, a lot of little files,
I guess. Yeah. A lot of little files. So, but that's, that takes some effort and some compulsion to do it. Whereas this is a nice way to just sort of jump in and say, oh yeah, I remember that game, and just fire it up and try it out.
Well, and the cool thing is that for people who, like, you can just say, oh, I played Dark Castle, I loved that game, and then you can just send them a link, and they don't need to know anything about Max. They could be 20 years old.
Yep. Cool.
Yep. What I liked was this one really hit the mainstream media a lot harder and a lot faster than other collections in the Internet Archive. So I think there was that. Helps that the Macintosh is still a thing in modern computing. But it's also that, as you said, send a link and someone can just start running with that game in a zero configuration environment. And it was very interesting to sort of see who was talking about these older 68K Macs from the early 80s. And it was good to see that nostalgia revived.
Cool. Let's move along here. Earl, you've got something interesting about an ancient MIT operating system.
Yeah, so apparently in the 60s, MIT had some PDP computers. Now, it's interesting that, PDP 11 is one more than PDP 10, right? But the PDP 11 was a mini computer family, whereas the PDP 10 was mainframe, like big iron kind of thing. And the artificial intelligence lab staff at MIT were dissatisfied with the direction that another group was taking with an operating system that they were building. So they decided to blaze a trail, go their own route. They developed an operating system that they called the Incompatible Timesharing System. And that was a play on another MIT timesharing system that had been developed called the Compatible Timesharing System. So they were just being a little whimsical there. But we were talking at the top of the show about preserving things, and in this case, the source code for this incompatible time-sharing system has been preserved, and if you want to, you can build it from scratch by going over to GitHub, grabbing the code that and the build scripts and such. The tool chain is described there that you need to do it. And this group of intrepid enthusiasts, they put this together, and you can go run it if you want to. And I think that's really cool. And it turns out that this incompatible time-sharing system does have a couple of claims to fame of historical note. One is that Wikipedia says a couple things here that I found interesting. One, the first device-independent graphics terminal output was created on this system. And that kind of device-independent GDI sort of world is something that we all totally take for granted these days, in the days of GPUs and accelerators, but new concept then. Also, for better or for worse, it sounds like Emacs, the editor, was developed on this system. Not an Emacs fan, definitely in the VI camp. Send your flames to earl@retrobits.com. But that is really important, though. Emacs is a very important piece of computing history, still very important today, and got built on this operating system. So we'll have a link to this GitHub in the show notes, and if you want to, you can build it. And then it also talks about how it bundles with, apparently, a couple of different emulators. I think one of them is SimH, which is a... SimH is actually more of a framework for emulators, kind of like... I won't say it's like MES, but kind of similar in concept, in that there's a bunch of SimH emulators for a variety of machines, including the PDP-10. So I'm going to download this and try it out. Try to build it and see what happens. This does have a C compiler. It does support TCP/IP with FTP and Telnet and those kind of things. So not only was it interesting, but it's got some connectivity that could probably still be talked into working today.
Cool. So we could you could actually serve a web page from it, perhaps.
Maybe if you.
Let's hope.
I'm not sure if you'd get hacked more quickly or less quickly, because who would know how to hack this thing?
Right, there's probably not a lot of PDP-10, you know, exploits. But
right.
I think there was at one point Lisa 2 serving web pages. But
although it's funny you bring up hackers, that one of the, as I was researching this, one of the things I read was it was an interesting part of the hacker community, this ITS, because it, as opposed to the project that this AI lab didn't want to have happen, ITS security was rather simplistic. You didn't even have to log in if you didn't want to. And to a certain extent, they encouraged guests to access the system, and it was available on the ARPANET. So it was, and they got tired of people finding ways to, or looking for ways to crash it. So they just put a command on there that would just crash the system. So they were basically taking the fun out of it, saying, hey, you know, you want a creative way to crash the system, just type crash and you'll kill it.
Nice.
Excellent. I can't quite decide if this is still true, but I think Lisa2.com is served on Lisa2.
So, ooh.
It says it is, but I'm not, the only thing I'm not sure about is if that is just only historically true. But anyway.
All right. Let's move on to the next thing. This is something that just popped up on here that I had not seen, but it's very cool. Olduse.net. This is it's sort of a wormhole, a time portal into Usenet of exactly 30 years ago. So today, on the day we're recording this, you can see things that were recorded on this same date, or that were posted to Usenet on this same date in 1987. And Usenet, for anyone who doesn't know, is kind of like the old global messaging forum that was spread across the internet and the early pre-internet for years and years. I poked through this a little bit. It's pretty cool. it's missing all of my favorite groups, which were various alt dot things. So there's a lot of comp lang forums, and there's probably some comp sys stuff and comp OS, and pretty cool. Oh, well, there's comp sys Atari 8-bit. Here we go. Oh yeah.
Really?
Very nice. Yeah.
Cool. Well, it's
pretty sweet.
This kind of predates my use of Usenet. I mean, it was small at this point.
Right.
1987 was still, like, I think I myself kind of started really seeing it around like 1990.
Yeah. So. Yeah, me too. Yeah, I know at the time I had no idea that this existed. It was not until I got in college that I knew about this at all. But so I'm kind of curious to see what happens when this starts to shadow the time period when I was actually posting stuff. It'd be pretty weird to
look at
this in 3 or 4 or 5 years and see what it looks like. Were any of you guys big Usenet newsers? Usenet newsers? Newsers? Users?
I was around the same time that Paul was talking about. Early 90s.
No, in both time periods.
In no timeline were you using this.
No.
Yeah, I really did like it there for a while. I mean, like, I was pretty into that.
Yep.
Well, you could find stuff out about Star Trek on the Usenet. I was a big Star Trek fan.
Sure. We didn't have Google. We didn't have things to actually search. You ask people questions.
We would find out rumors about upcoming episodes and such, and we had a saying back then, if it's on the internet, it must be true.
Nice.
Turns out that that's about as true today as it was then.
Right, yeah. So. Words to live by.
Or duck and take cover.
All right, well, that's one thing to watch if you're curious about old forum use. Michael, you've got something else. You've got something humongous or huge or gigantic.
Yep. Just a quick one. Just what caught me was actually the logo that they use, and then I just went diving off. What it is the Humongous CPM Software Archives. So if you're interested in getting going with CPM on your machine, here is a great repository of software collections. So that'll get you up and going. CPM is something which I tried dabbling with back in the mid to late 80s, but I never really got too far with it. The university only had one machine with a CPM card, and it was difficult to get time on that machine. And funnily enough, they didn't like us opening up the machines and slotting in extra hardware. So
killjoys.
They're killjoys, yes. I think they ended up those Apple II Europluses ended up getting security locks on their cases to stop us from putting extra cards in or reconfiguring it, because I know at one stage we picked up some CPM Z80 clone cards fairly cheap, and we were just wanting to get going with those. And the School of Science decided that students were not supposed to be adding hardware or moving things around inside the machines, so they went and locked them down. As you said, killjoys. But
man,
I came across this, looked interesting, thought I would share it with our readers. Sorry, our listeners.
Cool. Yeah, I like the... I've never actually used CPM at all. It's just, it's always the kind of thing that I heard about all throughout the time I started using computers. People talk about CPM, but I have never used it at all in any capacity.
It was all business.
Right.
That's not fun.
Yeah. Like, who wants that? Business, schmizness. I will have to say, I really quite enjoy the website. I like the color scheme and the fake printer paper look.
Mm.
It's very nice. Normally, I think a lot of things that we see are not particularly nicely designed when you're looking at some sort of retro archive or something. But this actually looks pretty sweet.
So it seems to be sort of like just a collection of other repositories.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat to actually see some of these names, because I know some of these archive names from... like old Mac software and stuff, Simtel 20 and, the WU archives. Like, they were archives of CPM collections, but, also other things. So I will have to dig around in this more in the future.
Cool. Paul, you've got something for us. a new bit of Spectrum Kickstarter goodness.
Yeah, so this just appeared, I think maybe like a day or two ago. But this is the ZX Spectrum Next Kickstarter. It's the ZX Spectrum Reborn. Okay, so it is a Kickstarter. They are looking for $320,000, and they are at $293,000. So they are really close already. There's 29 days to go. As I said, I think it just started like a day ago. So it is basically a new ZX Spectrum. I think it's a FPGA-based machine, so it is being an actual Spectrum, but on, you know, modern hardware. The processor is a Z80 at 3.5 MHz or 7 MHz modes. It has 512K RAM, expandable to 1.5 MB internally, 2.5 MB externally. There's a little thing, there's like an accelerator that it's designed to be able to put a Raspberry Pi Zero on there as an accelerator, which is pretty bizarre. And it's, you know, it's basically made to look like a modernized Spectrum. So it looks very cool. I don't think, as far as I can tell, everything is still in sort of like CAD drawings. So, except the board. The board seems to exist. The case is still in CAD format. But looks like something I would kind of like to have, actually. There's a bunch of Kickstarter levels, but I think the... So £99 gets you just the board. And I think £175 gets you, that's like the lowest level that will get you the device. And then above that, there are a couple of additional things like a real-time clock and Wi-Fi access that can be added into the ZX Spectrum Next Plus. And then, you know, much higher options. The early bird options are already gone. So just the board is estimated for August this year. And the whole device is estimated January 2018. So I'm quite tempted. I've been kind of like, I've had my eye out for Spectrum's Spectra, but I haven't, they're primarily all in Europe, so.
So you're not going to do the £5,000 pledge to get serial number zero?
I think I'm not, but I'm not sure that I will actually participate in the Kickstarter. I might, but I am fairly likely to get this eventually when it is made. Did any of you have a chance to look at this ahead of time? And it's just very new breaking news.
I had a quick look, and I quite like the way they're heading. I noticed they had some 3D print models of the non-working models of the case, so that you know, just to get an idea of the styling and the effect. Its price is a little bit. Put me off, you know, £175, that's quite a lot of coin. But again, it gets you a fully working machine that works within the modern environment. And I just love looking at PCBs. And it is another one of these well laid out PCBs. So it's just a beautiful piece of work. And I just wish I had the unlimited pocket money, because this would be tempting.
Uh-huh. Well, and I did stop short of saying some of the other stuff. I mean, like, it has RGB, VGA, HDMI out, SD card slot, you know, like, so, yeah, you're right, it's total modern environment version. Jack, you took a look at it?
Oh, just briefly. I think it looks interesting. I think, I feel like we have a little bit of history of recreated Spectrum devices not quite taking off. What was the one?
There was some official one that didn't happen, I think, right? Like that right. Sinclair himself was involved in.
Right. It'd be interesting if that one failed, but this one succeeds. So
yeah.
Which looks like, I mean, according to the money, they're about to make it. So
right.
It's cool.
And this one, it does seem like, at least as far as I can tell, all the background stuff is done. You know, I mean, like the
right.
board's basically ready, and you know, it's a matter of producing the case.
Yep. Which ought to be doable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems cool.
Yeah, and one thing I do like about this on the ports, not only is it all the modern stuff there, as well as audio in and out and tape connectors.
Nice. So.
What you need.
And DB9 compatible joysticks.
Also important. It's good.
Best of old and best of new.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move along here. I've got a bit of something else that popped up for me. Psygnosis, old software developer, made a series of games called Shadow of the Beast. I remember playing at least the first one of this on the Amiga, which was the first platform it came out on. And it was, technology-wise, it was incredible. Like, there's all this parallax scrolling and all this stuff. And I think I didn't get that far in the game because it was pretty hard, but it was just really, really cool to look at. And now someone has gone and made these available as package downloads for both Mac and PC. You can just download one thing and fire it up, apparently. I've not actually tried this, but I'm looking forward to doing so. So it does use it uses FSUAE, this some version of the Ultimate Amiga emulator, to run these things. And yeah, but it's nice that they're sort of packaged as just pieces of software rather than something you need to actually load up in an emulator. Like, the emulator is embedded inside of it. Have you guys ever played any of these games?
No, I haven't.
So I remember when I had an Amiga when this came out, and like, this was something that people got really, really excited about just because of the graphics. I mean, at the time there was really nothing like it. So I'm looking forward to poking at this again because it's pretty cool. And there's a video in the attached link that shows it for a variety of platforms, including something that looks like it might be, yeah, it actually is a Spectrum. There's a Spectrum version, obviously a lot less colorful. And as you go farther along in the video, they're showing mostly the Amiga version, which, you know, by today's standards, it's not quite as amazing as it was at the time, but still pretty cool. It's basically a platformer where you're this weird creature running left to right forever and ever fighting monsters.
Yeah, the Amiga is one area that I'm hoping to get into a bit. I, not so long ago, got a Amiga 500 that I have seen, you know, I've seen it work, but I haven't really done anything with it. So.
Right. Well, maybe playing this would give you
right.
a sense Motivation. Of a reason why you ought to.
No doubt.
All right, moving along. Now it's time for a word from our sponsor.
You've heard or read about low-cost personal computers. Today, you can see and buy the price leader, Radio Shack's famous under $600 system. Learn how computing can benefit your business, profession, record-keeping, and your education. Come into your nearby Radio Shack today. You will be convinced. The TRS-80 personal computer system, only $599, built and serviced by Radio Shack, a Tandy company.
Okay, welcome back. It is time for the retro computing gift idea. And seeing as this is episode 151, which is Roman numeral CLI, we have a CLI themed item here, which is the Shell Prompt Geek/Nerd t-shirt. Especially showing you a greater than sign followed by an underscore, which I guess ought to technically be blinking, perhaps, but this shirt does not blink, as far as I know.
Yeah, not in the 1795 version.
No. That's an additional user-installed option, perhaps.
So you'd say that the CLI Roman numeral is what prompted this particular gift idea.
Very nice.
I would say so. Oh, man. We are on a roll.
Yeah, I guess there's
not
a whole lot more to say about this, except that...
No, it's a t-shirt. Yeah. It has some different colors, sizes. Available for men and women. I want you to know.
Cool.
And, yep, there it is. You can find the link in the show notes. Let's move along. Auction time. Earl, you've got something.
Yeah, usually with eBay auctions for the show, I try to pick something that I would like to have myself. Mm. And this time, I didn't. I picked something that I wouldn't want to have, but I think is an absolutely lovely piece of history that would be great for a Tandy TRS-80 collector. This is a TRS-80 Model 1. It's the original 4K Model 1. And mm-hmm. if you look at the pictures, it not only works, but it's in beautiful condition. Mm-hmm. It's got some of the original books, and you can actually see in the pictures the machine operating. Mm-hmm. When I looked at the keyboard unit, it didn't look like underneath the space bar that it had the wearing off of the whatever it is, the coating that was on the plastic there that is so typical of the Model 1 that you'll see, you know, that area where your palms tend to rest gets really discolored. But in this case, it was in really nice shape.
Yeah. Funny you should mention that. That was actually the first photo that I went and zoomed in on. For precisely that reason. There just seems to be, it looks like more just a bit of a lighting artifact picked up there. But as far as a Model 1 goes, no upgrade modifications, and it is in such a beautiful condition. This is a nice machine.
It really is.
Yeah, it really looks like it didn't get any use in real life. Yeah.
Right.
Well, being only a 4K machine, that's understandable, but...
right.
So I think it's a $200 bid or a $400 buy it now. I think the $200 bid is eminently reasonable for what this is.
Yeah, for the shape it's in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's my pick.
Invergrove Heights. I think that sounds like someplace that's featured on Little House on the Prairie.
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's a very nice looking machine. Like you said, there's no wear and tear that is visible at all. Very cool. And I'm not going to buy it either. But for the right person, sure. Michael, what do you want to share with us today?
Well, the first one, now, I like how it says it's possibly unique. Well, I've never seen it before. This is an advertising paint tin for Painter 2, optimized for the Power Macintosh. I've never quite seen a promo item like this. The tin is authentically rusty. It looks like something that you would find sitting on a shelf down in the basement or at the back of the garage. But it's actually a promo unit. I don't know if the software actually came in the tin or whether it was just used for an advertising shoot. But it caught my eye, and I don't know if I'd pay £40 for it, but it definitely is unique, eye-catching, and possibly something you've never seen before. And if you want it, go for it.
Yeah, my impression from looking at that is that it actually did contain the software. Like, maybe it still does.
Yeah. Pretty bizarre.
I can't decide if I've seen that before. I think I think the icon maybe looks like that, and I think, you know, this would have been pictured in the ads and things. So, like, I can't quite be sure if I've seen this before or just representations of it in ads and things. But it's very cool. And the fact that it's totally rusted now is also sort of pleasing.
Yeah, it blends in quite well with all those old paint tins sitting at the back of the shed.
Yeah.
Okay, and the other one which I found, I've put that in the You've Got to Be Kidding department. I do not doubt that this is ultra rare. I don't know if I would pay $199 for it. But if you want a basic function calculator that has an Apple logo on it, this is the item for you. So I suspect that this is out of the old Apple catalog, the miscellany of Apple-branded stuff, as every computer company made this stuff available, predominantly for internal use and for sales people to sort of like give away, promo type stuff. So if you're into collecting promo items, these two might interest you. But I still think that $200 for a very basic calculator is right out of my it's not going to be in my collection anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that's another one that I'm going to have to pass on. Interesting to see, though, for sure.
Yeah, that's a dangerous area to get into if you wanted to collect all those little promotional things.
Right.
You have to have a lot of time to find them and have to be very rich.
And maybe you have to be a bit silly.
Yeah, right. Insane, yeah.
All right. Paul, what have you got for us? You have a number of interesting things here.
Yeah, just sort of maybe even a weirder collection than usual. But the first one is a box of hard drive platters. I can't think of a thing to do with these except art, really. I think it said it's like 25 pounds of 25 plus pounds of 5-inch hard drive platters. No hard drive mechanisms. These are just the platters. They're all scratched up, you know. Clean room left long, long ago. They look kind of neat in a way. I'm sure they're actually probably fairly heavy. I mean, like individually heavy, but
right.
So anyway, can you think of anything to do with one? Make a very heavy mobile.
Just like throw them at things.
Slip them into a floppy drive, a floppy disk sleeve to confuse people.
Yeah.
I have the Big Brother hanging up on my wall.
Nice.
One of the 14-inch platters from the PDP-11 RLO2 drive. And they're nice. You know, they're shiny. They're a interesting conversation piece.
Yeah.
But I don't think I need that many. I could probably wallpaper the whole room with the number that they're selling there.
Yeah.
Right. That's a lot.
It's sad to see these because if you see them out of their, like outside of their case, they're gone. they're no good.
I hope they weren't taken from working Seagate 225s because the ST225 you can still sell for something like $50 a piece on up.
Yeah. Don't know. Yeah. I assume. It seems like the seller at least knew what to call them, so presumably knew. Like, I don't know why anybody would have taken these out. I suppose if you were told you have to throw away 150 Seagate 225s, you might say, well, maybe I can just save this part. But, okay, anyway. So, the next thing actually just came up, I think came up last time when we were talking about microcomputer trainers. I found the auction set that, you know, the sort of modern microcontroller trainer. So I've got a link to the 6502 one, but there, this seller has a number of them. The 6502 one is $120. There's an 8088 one, a 6802 one. I think this was, we were talking about the Heathkit ET3400 last time as a, like an old style version of these. But, so if you wanted a new style version of these, I have located it.
Cool. It looks pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. They look fun. Okay, and then the next one, this is going to be, there are 17 hours left on this as I'm talking about it now, so this will be gone by the time you hear this. However, it's kind of a cool thing that I thought was worth pointing out. It is music on the PDP-1X. It is a vinyl record that apparently an MIT student sent to somebody. There's a letter just dated December 13th, 1971. Says, "Dear Merlin Murray, enclosed is a recording of music played on one of the computers here at MIT. For years I've been meaning to do this, but I've always put it off, and finally did make a master and ordered the records. They arrived just after Christmas last year, and I figured I'd send them anyway. I've finally gotten around to doing it. Happy holidays." From Steve Burns, who I believe was an MIT student at the time, and refers to some of the people who actually kind of like got the PDP-1X making this music. But so it's an interesting artifact and, you know, obsolete in various ways. Cool to see.
I would love to hear this.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. It is currently, there are two bids on it. It is up to $51, and hopefully whoever wins this will make it available.
Yep. Let's hope. Interesting.
Yeah, that's and actually, just as a complete side note, you know, so this letter is from S.K. Burns, says MIT Room 20B, 2014, and that sent me down this huge like trip because I know that room was like, I know where that room was. I was a grad student in that same building, Building 20, which is this crazy, like, just after World War II, they put up this big, crazy, huge plywood building with, it was sort of shaped like an E, except that it had four, you know, horizontal sections. So each of these was a wing, and there was the B wing, C wing, D wing, E wing. And so this guy was in the B wing, second floor, 20B, 2214. And so I then had to search my email to try to figure out, because I couldn't remember my room number, and I had to figure this out. And so, you know, whatever. It's an interesting sort of trip through my email archives. But I remember that building, that was a great building. but I remember making a marathon level, you know, like where you would run through the building and, I don't know, whatever. I'd have to put monsters in there somewhere. But it's like I actually got blueprints of the building so that I could do this. And I failed to be able to find my marathon level, but I'm hoping somewhere I'll still have it. Anyway.
Cool.
Totally unrelated to the eBay auction, but it's salient in, you know, like what I did in the past week.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. Next thing is Radio Shack MC10, TRS-80 micro color computer MC10 in its box. It looks nice. I think we've linked to these several times before. This is one of the nicer, cheaper ones that I've seen listed. It has its full box. The box is not too beat up. The computer doesn't seem to have any burns on it or anything like that. For some reason, seem too often. $25 buy it now. Shipping from Canada to me is $20 economy shipping. So if you're looking for one, I would have possibly gotten one of these, except that I already have one, so I don't need to. Although this same seller has also a 16K RAM expansion module in the box, which I think you might also want to buy at the same time, because I think these are largely useless with their built-in memory.
Mm, right. Cool.
And then I guess the last thing I was going to mention, it's old IBM software from 1983 called WordProof. It is from the personal computer word processing series. Comes in an IBM binder, seems to have some spots on it of hopefully not mold or something, and I've never heard of this before, maybe just me, but it's early word processing prior to Microsoft taking over the world, and WordPerfect, I guess, also taking over the world. But is WordProof familiar to anyone else here?
No.
I actually have WordProof in my storage closet here.
Uh-huh.
I think it might just be a spell checker, not an actual word processor itself.
Yeah, it was familiar, so I've just gone and just looked it up. So yeah, it's a standalone spell checker for, you know, back in the days when that was an extra. So right. 125,000 standard English words, find synonyms and anagrams, features built-in screen editor, add your own words, specialized words to its list. So yeah, it's
cool.
Pretty much a standard spell check add-on.
Okay. Yeah, I always kind of like these IBM binders. There's
they're neat.
Mm.
They look very businesslike, but yet inside the very colorful cover on this and the weird sort of purpley pink discs.
Well, as a bonus, mine doesn't have the speckles.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think it's probably better not to have the speckles, actually. I worry that it's like mildew or something, but
I think those are flavor crystals.
Ah, that's what it is. But anyway, I thought it was neat because I hadn't had a title I had not heard of before. My experience with IBM PCs is a little spotty. By the time I was doing any kind of word processing, it was, you know, I was using Word 2 or something. So,
WordProof. All right. Well, I guess that wraps up the eBay auction section. And I think it's time to head towards wrapping things up here. Anybody else have anything they want to add in here at the end?
Well, I built a new computer.
Oh.
Nice.
I hadn't done a build in, it's probably a few years. Mm-hmm. So I put together a gaming rig based on the Ryzen 7 new processor from AMD. It's got 8 cores and 16 threads, so can do 16 things simultaneously. It's pretty interesting when you bring up the Windows Task Manager and they, where they have the boxes for the CPU graph, it's got 16 of those little boxes. It's kind of crazy. So that and an NVIDIA GTX 1070 video card. So I put it all together, and it didn't work. So I took it back to Fry's, and I said, what's up? And it turned out, since this processor is so new, the motherboard or the processor or whatever had a compatibility issue with the RAM. It wasn't, it should have worked. It was spec'd correctly, but it didn't work. And they swapped it to a different RAM manufacturer, to Corsair, and it started working. But the whole thing had me sweating bullets, because you do a build and you've spent, you know, you dropped a bit of coin on this stuff and then it doesn't work and you're like, oh crud, what did I do wrong? I didn't do anything wrong though, but I love it. But I, you know, the funny part, and probably the reason I bring it up here, is as I was building it, I was thinking someday I'll look back at this and think, wow, this is retro.
Yeah,
that old
when
thing.
We have, you know, 1,000 core processors that are basically doing everything in parallel, and you know, we have direct neural links and stuff like that. I'll probably, you know, remember the good old days when we
before there's the predictive everything that made it do what you wanted before you actually knew you wanted it.
Yeah, exactly, before the singularity, so to speak, I guess. So,
right.
So that's my parting shot.
Cool. Well, I have something that is not a new computer, but is a thing for an old computer. I've heard the guys on Antic a while talking about this website, this company called Edladden, edladden.com. It's from a guy named Ed Kelly. And they make and sell these video game controllers with the DB9 for plugging into an old Atari, Commodore, what have you. And they're using arcade components. So they're nice micro switches, and they're built into these metal boxes that aren't heavily weighted, so they don't flop around or anything. And it's actually really cool. So I bought one of these. I bought the Super 78. So these are ideally suited towards an Atari 7800, which was their late 80s console. The main difference in terms of controllers for that is it actually allowed for having two distinct buttons that could do different things within a game. Whereas previous consoles and video and computers and stuff from Atari and Commodore, everybody else really just had one on these DB9 controllers. So this one has two buttons. I do not have a 7800. I've only actually plugged this into other Atari stuff, and actually both buttons work. So I don't really know how these things are wired up on the 7800, but something is different. Anyway, it works with everything, and it's really interesting loading up a game that I remember playing 30 years ago with some crappy joystick, like, you know, a standard Atari joystick or whatever, and suddenly with a proper joystick that feels just like what you'd have in an arcade cabinet, it becomes a whole different thing. And the frustration of dealing with a crappy joystick is gone, and suddenly you're left with, oh, I'm actually failing at this just because my own skill is lousy. So I have nothing else to blame. Very cool. They're relatively expensive for being a video game controller, but again, they're in a nice heavy metal box. And I don't think that, I mean, considering the actual content, I don't think the price is out of line for what it ought to be at all. And in fact, I had some correspondence with Ed Kelly, who runs this. He actually even sent me an itemized list of the components in a typical one of these, and showing that their actual markup on this is not very high at all. So,
nice.
He's actually doing this as a sideline of his other business, constructing other kinds of hardware. He had the capacity and the ability to make this sort of thing, and started doing it. So there are a few different ones. There's some that have dual sticks, and there are some that are for ColecoVision, and or maybe the ColecoVision ones are not coming out just yet, but they're on their way, I think.
I like how you can choose the, like, what style, like, joystick ball you want. Like, if you want like a sort of clear gem one, or a just regular kind of like opaque red one, or purple,
blue. Yep, that's right. When you're buying, you can choose the layout if you want left hand or right hand, and choose the colors for all the things. So I bought one with a translucent red stick knob, and then green and blue buttons. RGB.
Nice.
Just because I had to choose something.
I approve of those choices. I might well have made those very same choices.
Yep. So anyway, if you're looking for one of these joysticks, it's very cool. If you're looking for any kind of joystick, it's very cool. And I know there are actually adapters for plugging these kind of old-style joysticks into a USB adapter for running on a modern computer as well, which ought to work just fine with this, too. I haven't tried it, but it could be interesting to try this with new games on a new machine as well.
Yeah. Two buttons, though. I mean, it seems like that's the problem with like modern controllers. It seems like there are more buttons than I have fingers.
Right. Yeah. By a long shot. Yeah. So I don't know what kind of games will actually work well with two buttons these days, but we'll see. Anyway, in my correspondence with Ed, I mentioned that I would probably talk about this, and he was kind enough to give me a coupon code to share with our listeners. So anybody who buys one of these and enters the coupon code RCR will save 10% on the total price.
That's very cool.
See, and this is why you listen to the end of the podcast.
That's right. Anybody who skipped out early is not getting this juicy knowledge. So yeah, edladen.com. Pick what you want, buy what you want, coupon code RCR, and save 10%.
I just might.
And thanks very much to them. That's a neat offer.
Yep. Thank you, Ed. And, Michael, you've got something else here that seems interesting, too.
Yeah, it's not a piece of retro equipment, but I'm picking up this coming weekend a 100-sheet feed document scanner. So I have many ring binder documentation sets for my software. And one of the things that with this is that a lot of the documentation isn't available as a PDF, or it's not available as a quality PDF. So when the opportunity came to pick up this, I grabbed it. It also, as well as having the capacity to do up to 100 A4 letter, it's also duplex, so I can scan both sides, and it will also take up to A3, so I've got quite a few extra bits and pieces, so looks like I'm going to be able to really hit my to-scan pile and get a lot of that sorted out and get those back up to posting the PDFs.
Excellent. Cool.
That is awesome, Michael. I've got one of those sheet-fed duplex scanners, and I'll tell you, for preserving things, it's just so nice.
Mm. Yeah, I've got a few binders that have got odd-sized pages, so it'll be good to actually get those out of the binder and through this, and at least that way I can have the PDFs available here on my server and my tablet to make it a bit easier to reference that material. But and the upside of that is that I'll get that all posted up to the Internet Archive and probably BitSavers.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Very nice. It's nice to have big new pieces of hardware to help us deal with things like that. I've been thinking about getting a bigger scanner. I just have the only scanner that I have at home is a quite modern HP all-in-one printer, scanner, copier thing, which is fine for a sheet of paper, right? But, you know, we have some bigger things like the scan.
Yeah, I tried doing even just a small manual with that, but, you know, put it down, scan it, flip it over, scan it, and then sort of, you know, even with a Adobe Acrobat to sort of like say, well, here are all my images, now suck it in, make it a PDF, and do the recognition on it. It just took ages just to do even the smallest booklets.
Slow going. Okay. Cool. And Paul, are you also organizing stuff, I hear?
I am, yes. Yeah. So it's as it has become probably, you know, sort of evident from many past episodes, I have, I'm at a university, I have an office, and I generally keep all my sort of like vintage stuff in the office, but we're about to undergo we have some like an external review of a sort. You know, some people are coming in and going to talk to us about what we need and what we have and where we're going, and then report to the, you know, the higher up administration. But it means people from the outside are going to see my office, and so I have to make it look like less of a garage and more like an office. So, so what I've been doing,
you want them to be able to see the office,
right? Right, exactly. So, and maybe, yeah, who knows? You know, maybe the Lisa and the, you know, 5150 and stuff will impress them enough that they will say. Of course, this has nothing to do with what the place is actually about. You know, like, it's not the academic pursuit we're in, but at any rate. So I've gotten a bunch of these little, like, clear, you know, rectangular bins, clear slash translucent, and putting things in them. And so now at least I'll be able to tell where things are. I think I actually was talking, this is a somewhat long-running project. I started this probably a month ago, so, but it's getting there, and it's, I don't know, it's kind of, it's nice to be able to visually identify where things are now.
Yeah. Nice. So. Yeah, cleaning up space like that does feel good. I recently was doing that in my workroom here, kind of organizing all my stuff, and it's nice to, for at least right now, know where I have things. I'm sure, you know, things will disperse and whatever, but it's nice to just go through things and sort it out.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, like, turns out I actually have some pretty cool stuff. Like, I, like, you know, there's all these things that I'm looking at thinking, oh, I really want to try this out. But
it's Christmas all over again.
Right.
Cool. Okay, well, that's it for this episode. You can find show notes for this and all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by just searching for RCR Podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. You can email us feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And of course, we are a proud member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. You'll find all sorts of retro goodies to listen to. And of course, please write a review on iTunes, giving us some nice words and some stars. I think at this time we are only accepting 5-star reviews. So you can save your 4-star reviews and lesser for other podcasts. We are only accepting 5 stars at this time. It's a technical limitation. I'm sure it'll get cleared up someday. But until next time, Retro Compute!